Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a man in San Francisco who transforms himself from a crackhead to a counselor. Thomas Warren worked in the municipal bus station. He was a repairman. Every Friday after work, it was off to the dope man for crack or heroin. These days, Thomas is still at the bus company and still in the repair business, but now he's helping his colleagues keep their own lives together. Thomas talks from experience. He's made it through his own drug and alcohol addictions. He's been locked up in a mental institution. The first time the bus company came looking for someone to volunteer as a peer counselor, Thomas put his name in, but the company said no, he hadn't been clean long enough. The next time they came looking, Thomas said no. But the company begged him to take the job, so he did. Now he says he has the double satisfaction of staying clean himself and figuring out streetwise ways to help others do the same. I'll ask Thomas to explain how he does it right after the news. It was a little over 20 years ago when crack became the drug of choice for people in search of a cheap, quick high. Thomas Warren was there. He says he and his girlfriend used to buy cocaine every Friday and cook it up themselves. Then later, dealers started to sell Ready Rock. It went straight into the pipe. Thomas still remembers the crackling sound of the little chunk as it warmed in the pipe. It was the sound that gave crack its name. He also remembers that was about the time when he began his own long fall into addiction. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I asked Thomas Warren to take me back to a time when he was seriously messed up. He told me about one binge. He'd missed a number of days at the bus repair shop where he worked, and he needed a doctor's note to explain his absence. So he decided to go to a doctor's office at the hospital. The thing was, hospitals made him nervous.
Before I went to the doctor's office, I had gotten high because I couldn't function, you know, without having drugs in my system.
Yeah.
So I go to the psychiatric department of this hospital, and they saw I was high, and it was like, you got to go to emergency, because I was telling them, you know, I was thinking about committing suicide and that kind of stuff, because I wanted them to get a sense of urgency so they could hurry up and give me the doctor's note. So when I got to the emergency room, they had a little balcony. And I was just leaning over it, looking down. And all of a sudden, they came running out there. Hey, hey, hey. I was like, I'm looking around to see who they're talking to, you know. And they were talking to me. They thought I was finna jump. I was like, hey, no. And they rushed me into the emergency department, you know, started putting IVs in me. And I actually woke up in a psychiatric institution. And I was like, where is this? I was in this room with just glass around and people in white suits in a padded room, and there was this one guy in a room next to me standing up in the middle of the bed talking to the ceiling and stuff, you know what I mean? And I'm like, where am I at? So I start bamming on the window, the glass, and the nurse come out and said, you're in, she named the place at a psychiatric institution. I said, what? I ain't crazy. You know, she said, well, we can't do nothing about
that. I'm just a crackhead.
You know what I mean? I ain't crazy, but that was really my first attempt at recovery when they sent me down there. And at the end of the 7 days, I remember my girlfriend coming to pick me up. As soon as I got out the car, I went straight to the dope man's house. And I remember shooting some dope and then starting to cry like, man, I just...
Yeah, what was that 7 days for, right? Yeah,
exactly. I just left the treatment facility, you know what I mean? And
was there a moment... Tell me, Thomas, was there one moment, though, in that, either in the 7-day program or the 28-day program or the 6 months that came after that, was there one moment when you thought to yourself, I actually can clean myself up? I can make a life without dope?
Yeah. In the 6-month program, I didn't have to do it all at once. So all I had to do was not get high today. And there were times when, you know, it'd be like, well, don't get high for this hour, because the urges would come. You know, and old behavior was like, just, man, it was an automatic response, man. if I thought about I was getting money, when I it would be like, man, my mouth would start watering, the thoughts would be running, and it'd be like, okay, this is how we got to do it, and be sitting in treatment. You mean thinking about getting high and how I'm gonna do this?
It went on for the next 5 years. Thomas would try to get clean, and then he'd slide back. But 1989 was a turning point for him and others at work. That's when mandatory drug testing was implemented.
I was clean at that time.
So you were going to hold on to your job, but what was happening to the other people
exactly.
around you?
Well, they were being tested and losing their jobs because they had a zero tolerance for substance abuse when mandatory drug testing came on.
And is that when people started to turn to you and to say, hey, Thomas, how did you get to where you are? You know, what advice can you give me? Were people asking you at that time for some ideas or advice?
Yes. Most of them wouldn't believe it was possible. You know, like, man, I know you doing something. I was like, no, I ain't. You know, they'd come to you and they'd say stuff about their friend. But a lot of them I was getting high with already when I was on the property before right. I got clean.
So you know, knew who was using. You knew who was smoking.
Oh, yeah.
What was the strategy?
You know, like, how did you?
Just to listen or to say, you know, here's what I did. Here's what you have to do.
How I got started was people would offer me stuff. So there was a recovery process that I had where I'd go to meetings or I'd meet with some guys who were doing the same thing I was doing. So I'd always invite them. I said, man, well, you can come on and go with me over here. You know, or we'd go at it from another angle. Some of them be talking about they're having problems in their relationships, right? And we'd be talking about that, and then they'd be talking about their drinking and their drug and use. And, you know,
but
it was always...
I have a question for you, and that is that in most places where I've worked, there's always been someone who, you know, had a few more miles on them, had a little bit more wisdom, and people would go to that person for advice. But you chose at one point to kind of do this in a formal way, to become the on-site counselor, not, you know, the sort of peer counselor or someone that people could go to and if they were having troubles with their relationship or with their banker or with their girlfriend or with drugs. Why did you choose to make that something formal? Why didn't you just sort of keep it loose, like Thomas is cool, go talk to him?
I guess because, you know, that's a good question. There was just something in me that thought I could make a difference. Like I could make a difference. And it just needed to happen in a different arena than just, you know, right there with the people who were in my immediate circle.
Yeah, because this would mean that people you'd never met before were
exactly.
coming up to you and saying, here's my stuff, right? Help me out.
Exactly. And then when management and the union got together to say, you know, we need a place where people can come voluntarily to say that they have some issues without any kind of punitive damages, right? So at the time when I was doing what I was doing, you know, being clean and talking with people, people said, man, you ought to apply for that. You ought to apply for that, right? You'd be perfect for that. You'd be perfect for that. But I wasn't going to apply for it because I didn't think I was good enough to do it, you know, or think that I would get it.
Let's talk about some of the people that you met. I understand that early on you had your own stumbles as a counselor, like when you had to deal with that, with an addicted couple. That was a difficult time for you. Tell me about that.
There were two guys who actually came into my office around about the same time. So they would always come together because they kind of hung out together, right? So they were dealing with substance abuse, crack cocaine.
Were they high at work or were they just sort of partying on the weekend?
Well, I can't say they were high at work. They'd always come to my office like I relapsed. Most of the time it'd be after the payday they'd relapse or they wouldn't show back up for work for 5 days. You know, just be missing in action. And then they'd want to call and come to the office.
Right.
You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So they do good. You know, they'd be like gung-ho. Oh, yeah, I got 5 days. I got 10 days clean, Thomas. Da-da-da-da. Doing what they're supposed to be doing. Going to meetings, going to work.
And you're feeling good about it. You're thinking, hey, I'm helping these people. Okay.
Oh, man. Right. Because now I'm having me helping people mean something about me.
This is your identity.
Excitement.
This is about
you. Yeah,
right?
My identity. Exactly. So one day they was just like, I was just too through with them. One of them, he came in and he says, man, I relapsed again. And I was like, so I just went off on them. You know, I started using some words that weren't professional.
I was going to say, we're going to get the clean version of this.
You know, some words
you cussed them out, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I could just remember being so upset, like they had done something to me. And just like, wow, I'd never been so upset before.
But if they weren't clean, then you had failed.
Exactly.
But why is that such a why is that such a wrong way of looking at it? I mean, you're getting kind of personally involved with the people that you're supposed to help. Is there a line that you crossed there, Thomas, that you shouldn't have crossed?
Exactly. I have to be there available for the client. So it's a neutral ground. I got to see how angry I got when they weren't doing what I thought they should be doing.
Whatever happened to those two?
One of them got terminated, and the other one is still working there and still relapsing.
His word. This counseling job that you're doing, though, it's more than helping people with addiction, with drugs and alcohol, right?
Yes.
So you're dealing with power relationships, anger on the job. Give me an example of a bus driver's type of anger.
All right. Bus driver having a bad day. Nobody know he having a bad day. Passenger get on the bus, ask for a transfer, right?
Right.
The passenger didn't pay no fare. Operator goes smooth off on the person, starts cussing him out.
Why doesn't he just say, get off the bus? You're not paying any money, get off the bus.
That was an option, right? But at that point, something else was going on with him in his mind. Okay. So he wasn't even present to what was happening. And he took it out on the passenger.
But the driver goes off on this guy, starts shouting at him?
Oh, man. Shouting at him, cussing him out, tying up the bus. Just.
Now, you were talking to the bus driver, right?
Yeah, the bus driver, they actually.
So what did he say? What was his version of it?
Well, he was upset because the guy got on his bus, right? He thinks the bus is his bus. So you're disrespecting him if you just walk past him on the bus.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
You got that? All right. So that's an issue in itself. You don't disrespect me. Now, he was having an issue with his live-in mate that nobody knew about. But he bringing that issue to work, too.
Right. I mean, he's already got a pretty short fuse, is what you're telling
me. Exactly. So when he came in, then he could see how out of place his response to that individual was. You follow me? Because he kept blaming it like, well, the guy shouldn't have disrespected me. You just can't respond like that.
Thomas Warren works as a peer assistant. That's an industry name for an in-house counselor at the Municipal Bus Office in San Francisco. In just a moment, I'll talk with Thomas about how he uses his own childhood experiences to connect with his coworkers. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Thomas Warren is a peer counselor. He helps his coworkers at the municipal bus station with troubles they have at work. And Thomas knows trouble. He grew up in a housing project at a naval shipyard in San Francisco. Life as he knew it changed when he was introduced to alcohol while hanging out with his mom's boyfriend.
There was an area of the city where the alcoholics would hang out. So we'd go down there. They'd take us down there. They'd buy the alcoholics a drink, and they'd sit around and chit-chat. And I remember it was me and my brother. We were about 4 or 5. And they were drinking orange juice, right? But they were drinking vodka and orange juice. And, you know, we didn't know. You know, we kids, 3, 4 years old.
You were
so they give us the
4 years old?
Exactly. About 4 or 5 years old, something like that. Somewhere in that age. And so they're giving us we're drinking the orange juice, not knowing, you know, vodka. And then I remember when we were coming home, we were staggering. You know, and my mom would tell that story to her friends, and that's how I knew you know, what had happened.
When she told that story, was she telling it like a family joke or like she was ashamed? How did she use that story?
Oh, she just talking like she talked to her friends, you know what I mean? Just telling like, yeah, I didn't know he was doing giving them kids that alcohol, and I didn't know why my kids were staggering when I was carrying them home like that. So it wasn't like she was upset about it, but she was telling them about it.
It became part of the Warren family lore then.
Exactly. Was that what you were saying? It'll be a story that she tell, you know what I mean?
What about drugs,
she
Thomas?
She don't even tell it to certain friends.
What about drugs? Well, when did that start?
My first introduction to drugs was only around 12 years old in junior high school, smoking weed, marijuana, and then there was pills. Mm-hmm. I remember in the eighth grade. So this particular day, I was at a neighbor's house, and I was in her medicine cabinet, and I had seen these Reds, which were sleeping pills, but they would get you high. So I saw some in her medicine cabinet, and I took some of them, right? And so when I got to school, I took one of them. And man, it was a feeling like, woo. And when I got to class, the teacher knew that there was something different about me. So he set me down, and then after class, he told me, I don't know what you did, but I know something, you took something or did something. And he kind of talked to me about, I shouldn't do that.
Did you admit to him at the time, Thomas? Did you say, yeah, I took a pill?
No, I was ashamed. I was just like embarrassed because I knew he cared about me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I respected him. So I didn't want him to think I was a bad person or something like that. I didn't never admit it, but I knew he knew. And that was really my first experience, knowing that here's something that can change the way that I felt.
So how old would you have been when you figure you started using drugs on a fairly regular basis?
Oh, I'd say 14. When I left junior high school and got into high school, I used to just hang out in the garage on the way to school. And in the garages is where you sold weed just to have lunch money. Then we started gambling.
And nobody
just wanting to fit in.
Yeah, nobody, not your mother, not no one sort of intervened and said, you know, you can do more than this, you can be more than this?
Well, she didn't really know what was happening until one day, because she had to go to work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because she was the one that had to go to work to provide, because my father wasn't there. They had gotten a divorce, and he had moved out and was like four kids. So my mom had to go out and do some work. So she would be thinking, you know, I'd be going to school. Because I'd be leaving every morning, getting dressed, but not going. So one day, she had came home early, and the school had called. I remember that day when I came in, she said, so where you been today? I said, at school. She was like, well, if you've been at school, how come they say you ain't been to school in 30-something days? So I said, hey, you know, I was like, I've been going. I just ain't been going to homeroom. Because homeroom was where they took roll at.
Yeah.
So
was your mother buying this or not?
No, she was not buying it. I'm going to tell you what happened. She was not buying it. She said, in this house, either you go to school or you get a job, right? And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to school. And she was like, oh, yeah, you going to go to school. So she said, no, you better get your stuff and go because you think you've grown.
How old were you at this time, Thomas?
Oh, I was about 15. You know what I mean? I was in the 10th grade. So she told me to go upstairs, get my clothes, and go. I was like, huh? She said, you heard me. Go upstairs, get your clothes, and go. And I remember standing there just like dumbfounded, not believing she was telling me and not believing that she was
serious.
She said.
Yeah.
Exactly. And she said she would if I didn't, she was going to call the police. And the way she said that, I knew she meant it. Do you know what I'm saying? And at that point, you know, I started like, Ma, I promise you, I'm going to go to school. Like that. And from that day forward, I went to school. It wasn't like it took me two or three days to make a decision or choice.
Uh-huh.
From that day, I went to school and I graduated from high school. That was like a turning point in my life. When my mother drew that line, like in the sand,
yeah,
like either it's this or that, and when she said, I'm going to call the police and you got to go, just reality just hit me, man.
after Thomas Warren's mother laid down the law. As he said, he finished school, and he even got a job. But even that wake-up and those changes didn't stop Thomas from following his friends further into the world of drugs.
My first introduction to cocaine was around 16 years old. A friend of ours, a parent, used to have it, you know, and so we'd go to their house, and they'd go into their parent's stash, take some of it, and that was my first introduction to cocaine. My first introduction to heroin was when someone told me, they called it pineapple cocaine. I said, pineapple cocaine? And I remember sniffing it and throwing up afterwards. Like, man, that stuff made me so sick. But it didn't stop me, you know, from snorting more of it, eventually shooting it. And for the next, till I was 36 years old, you know, actually giving it up.
What was the low point, Thomas? What was the reason why you did give it up? Did you just at one point look at yourself and say, who am I or what am I doing?
Well, you know, I had, there's a lot of different things that happened, but the one event, I remember I was at my girlfriend's house and I had gotten paid, you know, and I didn't want to spend up all the money again like I always do. So I gave her the money, some of the money, right? And I said, look, no matter what happens, don't give me this money. She said, okay now. Well, I ain't going to give it to you. Needless to say, I gave her the money and I left and did what I did. And shortly I came back asking for the money. And she was like, I ain't giving it to you. You told me not to give it to you.
She knew you wanted to get high.
Oh, yeah. She knew.
Okay, so she's saying no, and you're saying give me the money. Where does this
start? Yeah, exactly. So then it became, she said, no, I ain't giving it to you. So then I got violent, hit her, and it scratched the retina of her eye, right? So she couldn't see. So then we had to go to the hospital, right? And I remember being at the hospital with her, you know, and when she came out, she had a patch over her eye, and they was talking about her eyesight might be gone, and you know, and I just felt so bad. Do you know what I mean? Just, man, how could you do that? You know? Like, I wasn't a bad person, you know? But I just felt so low. That was a low point. And so I had had a friend who had already been in recovery. You know, actually the first person that ever showed me cocaine and told me about the pineapple heroin.
Mm-hmm.
That guy had actually gotten into recovery and been in recovery for about 2 years. And I used to see him coming through the community, and I'd be like, wow, he sure is doing good. But not having the courage to say, yeah, you know, I'd want to do that. But hitting that low point, I called him, and he actually was working at a detox facility. And I called him, and he told me to that he'd see if they'd get me in there. And I went down there the next morning, and they accepted me, and I went in. And so I stayed there for seven days. While I was there for those 7 days, it was like, you know, if I could just get through these 7 days, you know, I could always go back and do and get high again. You know, that was my thought. And then while I was there, this lady took an interest in me, and she said, you know, we got another program you can go to. And I said, oh, I don't think I want to go. I said, does it cost? She said, yeah, it costs. I said, well, I ain't got no money. She said, it only costs $10. I said, well, I don't even got $10. She said, don't worry, we'll waive it. And I said, let me go home and get some stuff, and then I'll go over there. She said, no, you ain't got to go home. We got a ride for you right now just to take you straight there. So every excuse I came up with, you know, just wasn't meant. So I wind up going to the secondary program, and it was a 28-day program. And it was in a hospital, you know, and while I was there, I heard this guy said, you know, people only come to the hospital because they sick. And I was like, huh? He says, yeah, what you have is a sickness or an illness. And that was the first time I had ever heard anybody call addiction a sickness or an illness. And I said, yeah, that's true.
My guest is Thomas Warren. He now does counseling for his colleagues at his workplace at the San Francisco Bus Company. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Thomas's counseling work is about more than getting clean. He could be answering questions about anything, domestic abuse or suicide. I asked Thomas where his more creative suggestions come from.
I ask myself some days, how did I know to say that? You know what I mean? It's just I've learned how to be with myself, you know, in a way where I'm not judgmental about it. And it just allows me to be with the persons who I'm dealing with. Something else just comes through, man. I can't label it. I just know if somebody gives you a gift, you want to say thank you. Do you follow me?
Kind of logical.
Yeah, exactly. It ain't no diabolical stuff. You know?
No, but it's serious stuff.
It ain't like rocket science.
I wonder if you've ever been
science.
Ever felt like you were threatened.
Oh, man. Felt threatened. I've been threatened. People have anger issues, man. I'm clear about that.
Well, what kind of threat have you seen? Give me an example.
Oh, I threatened to get beat up, do some bodily harm, or you better not come out this door. But it's not an everyday thing. Since I've been doing this for 8 years, I've only been threatened twice. And then one of the guys who threatened me, he brought me a box of donuts a couple of weeks later. You know what I mean? A whole box of donuts.
Wait, first of all, he threatened you, and then later he showed up with a box of donuts.
Then later showed up with a box of donuts and apologized.
Were you looking at those donuts thinking, I don't know?
Exactly correct. You know, like,
so did you have one or not?
I don't remember. I really don't remember, you know, if I ate one. I probably did, yeah.
What was the other time when you were threatened?
The operator just got...
Got a little angry?
He was just angry because of what I was saying to him about what he might could do, offering him other alternatives.
Yeah.
Every time I give him a suggestion, he keep telling me, that ain't going to work, that ain't going to work. I was like, so what you come here for? You know what I mean? You just come here to keep telling me what ain't going to work. Then he went just smooth off, man. You don't know me and da-da-da, man. I'll take you outside and beat you down and all that kind of stuff, man.
Thomas, you've had some pretty wild stories come into your office.
Yeah. There was an operator who, there's a bus that's supposed to leave before this operator's supposed to leave. He went around the corner and kept going without coming back to pick up the people. So then this other operator decided he was going to catch the bus and put the people on that bus.
So, wait a second. So you've got one empty bus ahead of another bus,
empty bus
full of passengers. And the
guy
with the busload of passengers is deciding to catch the other guy?
To catch the other bus so he can put them passengers on that bus because he shouldn't have done that. Some bus drivers, I'm not going to say all bus drivers, okay? Some of them think if there's a bus in front, then them is his passengers. And he didn't pick up his passengers, so now I got to pick up his passengers. You got that?
All right, so the guy with the full bus is chasing the guy with the empty bus. How does this end
with
up?
With the empty bus. They end up on top of this hill where the other bus cuts off the other bus. They get off the bus, start arguing, start physically fighting. The police come and the supervisors come, and they both got removed from the premises.
Did you have to talk to either one of these drivers?
Oh, yeah, that's how I heard about it. That's how I heard about it.
So how do you not laugh? I mean, really?
How do you not laugh? I'd be like, did this really happen? And they'd be like, yeah, this really happened, man. This really happened. I said, you were actually? And he'll say yes. You know what I mean? And maybe after about two visits, then it might be some humor there for him. So,
Now, what's your job there? Is it your job to try and come up with an answer to say this is what you should have done, or is it your job to just sit there and let them talk?
Pretty much to let them talk, because most people come up with their own solutions. Sometimes people come in and talk for an hour, hour and a half, and I just listen. Your own wife won't listen to you like that, you know, or your husband, right, for an hour and a half?
No.
No, you won't. I listen to them until they start telling the same story over again. When they start telling it over again, then I know this is like a repeat. That's like stuff being on a tape, right? then I know, hey, it's time to cut it off.
But this is interesting to me, Thomas, because when you talk about people having to find the solution to their own problems, that's exactly what you had to do with addiction. Nobody was going to say, you got to be clean and I need you clean by Thursday. I mean, it took you a long time and I guess a lot of sweat and a lot of tears to try and get there, but you had to do it yourself.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't that people weren't telling me. You know, people used to tell me all the time, boy, you're killing yourself. But I couldn't hear it. And sometimes, you know, you have to, like, say the same thing in a different way so that people can hear it.
Thomas Warren reminds me that he is not a recovered addict, but still a recovering addict. I was curious to know more about how he handles the cases where his wit and his own experiences aren't enough for him. He says that he manages to get through to people because he has selfish reasons for helping them. In just a moment, he'll talk about how counseling others continues to help him keep himself straight. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Thomas Warren offers a low-key kind of counseling to his fellow workers at the main office of the San Francisco Transit Authority. He's been doing this ever since he kicked his own addiction to both drugs and alcohol. He says the work he does with others in many ways helps him continue to face down his own weaknesses.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Because it just reminds me of the insanity that used to be in my life. I had that same kind of thinking. Like, only reason I can talk to other people or listen to them is because I can identify with it. I may not have done it exactly the way that they got into the situation they're in, but I've experienced that feeling that they're feeling when they say, man, I got to do something different about this. And if there's a situation that comes up where I can't find a place to identify with them, then I'll just be in the place of like, okay, let's see what's here.
But I can see this as being, you know, maybe humbling, maybe even humiliating for you because you end up having to go back to your own weakest moments.
Exactly, exactly. And sometimes I use those moments to get related with the people that I'm working with.
But isn't that a hard thing to do, to on a regular basis go back to some of the darkest, ugliest moments in your life?
No, it's difficult, and that's when I know it's appropriate. When I go to the place of, oh, you don't want to share that. It's like a secret I don't want nobody to know about me. But if I'm free from it, then I can share it. And so when I'm able to share it, it just gives me freedom too.
And is it a signal for you if you say, well, I don't really want to talk about this, but I guess I will? Because
exactly.
Do you
exactly.
also know that you're then putting something real on the table?
And exactly.
The other person in the room can't go, yeah, whatever. I mean, they can't turn
away.
No,
they usually don't. Yeah. They usually don't. Usually the room gets silent and it just be like, huh. And then they like open up like, wow, he is human too. You know, I ain't like that God or somebody in high authority that knows it all.
So you end up being a counselor who doesn't judge. You don't judge people.
Yeah, I do judge people, but I just learned how to
keep it to yourself.
Self, exactly. Exactly.
Do you like the work? You know,
I love my job. I do this job for free.
Not a lot of people would say that.
Yeah, I would. I would. I was doing it for free. My wife tells me all the time, you know, because we got people in our lives who I do this work with. And she said, you ought to be charging them. I just listen. They start talking.
Sounds like you're lucky. All. I mean, you could be dead.
Whoo, man, 1989, I OD'd three times, you know? And just, I remember OD'ing and everybody left me for dead. They robbed me, took my car, everything. Just left me in the house. And somehow I came to. That's some more of those circumstances that kind of led up to me saying, it's time for me to stop. A lot of people that I used to get high with did die. Not necessarily from the drugs, but the complications of using drugs.
Yeah.
Kidney problems, liver problems, things like that. Close friends, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, that's the generation, isn't it? The generation that, you know, sort of discovered crack, fell too far into it, and heroin use before anyone realized just how deadly that stuff could be.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think of yourself as a lucky man?
Blessed man. Not even lucky partner, blessed. Like, you know, there's like somebody was saying, hey, Thomas, over here. And I kept thinking it was meant over there. And then finally they said over here one day, and I said, I'm coming, partner. And then I started walking that road, you know what I mean? I started walking a road where I didn't know where I was going, as opposed to the road that I was familiar with. Because I knew where the road that I was familiar with would take me.
And that's the one we almost always stick to. Not
exactly.
Necessarily the right one.
Well, it'll take you to a place that you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And a lot of people like to be comfortable in life. Learning how to be comfortable with the uncomfortableness of life, if that's, you know, possible.
Well, Thomas, I see that I have kept you past your start time at the bus station, but I do want to thank you for coming in to share your story with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Dick.
Thomas Warren is a peer assistant or a counselor for his colleagues at the Municipal Transit Authority in San Francisco.
Read the signs, man, and then you'll know.
I was so mad, I wanted to cuss the funky driver on the funky bus.
One of my favorite features here at The Story is when I get to hand the microphone across the table to one of you for a version of what we call your story. We call it that because these are the stories that come from you, from your own private catalog of moments that matter to you. And what makes them work is that it doesn't matter how personal the stories are, they all have real meaning for the rest of us. Karen Dalton wrote to me about a boy who was a part of her childhood in Newark, New Jersey. Joey, she says, was always close but always slightly apart. Here's part of what Karen wrote to me. Joey was a Down syndrome kid that lived on our block. Joey was not allowed out of the house. He lived on the second floor. Joey spent his childhood playing with us from that second floor window in his house. I asked Karen to tell me more, and if it really was possible for Joey to participate in the play of the neighborhood kids from that second floor window.
Oh, sure. Sure, we always played together because we had kids in the backyards there. There were 3 yards between my house and Joey's house. All the yards were open, just with a little wire fence.
Yeah.
And we'd yell over, he'd yell back, or we'd play at Annette's house, and she had a pool, which was right under Joey's window, in the front and the back.
But Joey couldn't come down and swim.
No. He couldn't. He wasn't allowed out.
His parents wouldn't let him out.
No, he couldn't go out. They wouldn't. He would escape during the day and run out.
Well, it sounds as if his parents were so strict, I'd probably want to escape if I was Joey. Did you ever feel like Joey should be allowed to sort of be set free?
Well, I'm not really sure, because when he did get out, you know, some of the kids would run and scream. You know,
oh, like it was a bad thing. Here
out,
comes
like,
Boo
oh my
Radley.
God, here comes Joey. He's going to squeeze us to death. And that's really what he did. So he would always catch us and squeeze us. And, you know, he really could hurt you if you didn't tell him, like, Joey, not so hard.
Yeah, you have a slight build. You must have been even slighter as
crushed,
a young girl.
And my mother would be screaming out the window to let her down. And he was really sweet because he was starving. Really, for friends. Friends that he could actually physically play with.
So how did you integrate him into your childhood games?
Well, we'd play hide and seek in the front.
Yeah.
And we'd play by a tree, right by his window in the front. You know, that was our home base. You know, you hide like this. And he would always be out there at night. And we would sort of...
Out there, you know, in his window. I keep meaning...
In his window.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't really treat him like he was anyone special. He was just the kid on the block. Really. That... wasn't allowed out. And, you know, the more I think about him, it was sad, but they really protected him. I think they were afraid.
Was he close enough to the ground so you and your friends could kind of sit in the backyard and talk, and he could listen in on your conversations?
No, not really. Not unless sometimes we sat on his porch, and he could hear us through the rooftop. The second floor roof was over, and we can talk
so
like
he couldn't
that,
but, see you, but you're
no.
underneath the roof
yeah,
below his
and we
window.
Would hang out there at night. You know, we'd hang out on the stoop at night just in the city. That's what you did.
And would he talk to you? Would you
yeah.
talk to him?
He'd say things. He talked a lot about television. That's all he did was watch television. He was very smart. He knew everything that was going on in the news. So whenever he got a news flash, you know, we were the first to hear it, you know, about anything.
So big news events like...
Well, I say like President Kennedy died. He was just... he was horrified. Sobbing in the window.
Oh, because he lived his life through what
TV.
He saw on television.
Yeah, but everything, and he really only spoke of the tragic things that he saw on TV. You know, I don't really remember anything great like a big parade or right. something. It was always if somebody got killed, somebody was in an accident, he'd be in there, up there, just talking about it. And he'd cry. He cried a lot. Yeah, he's good. He's a big guy.
I have a question, though. So many kids of the age that you would have been at that time, Karen, tease kids with Down syndrome, kids with some kind of physical or mental disability. I mean, I was going to say it's in kids' nature, and I don't think it is but necessarily, but a lot of kids tease kids who they see as somehow different. Your gang, you never teased Joey?
No. Mm-mm.
You
Nobody
know
ever teased them. Nope. We never did. We were real close, tight little block. And he was on our block, and that's all there was to it. And we never teased him. I don't remember anybody ever teasing him. I can't say. We might have teased him, you know, if he came out and he played with us. Like, we tease anybody. You know, but we really weren't teasing people.
So there were times occasionally when he'd come out when he wasn't escaping?
No.
He was always on an escape mission.
He was always on an escape mission when he got out. And you could tell he just busted out. His eyes would be gigantic. His arms would be spread out. And he had these big fingers. You know, and we knew we were just going to get it.
He was a big kid then.
Yeah. He was short but stocky and a big head, big fingers, powerful.
Was there any humor in the relationship that he had with his parents? Like when he escaped, was that, you know, the father would chase him down the street laughing? Or how would that play out?
No. It wasn't funny. There was no humor in that at all. It was an emergency situation. You know, if the kids were outside and he got out, his mother would come and get him and take him back in and usually take both his arms, you know, and he could have easily gotten...
What, and pinned them behind him?
Yeah. And try and restrain him a little bit. And, you know, he could have certainly gotten away from his mom, but he didn't. And he went back in because he knew that's where he was supposed to be. But then when the kids weren't out... He'd get out and he'd run down the street, down the block to the church. And that's when his dad would have to come home from wherever he worked and bring him back up the hill, you know. And they didn't find it funny.
The parents would be angry with him.
Oh, very much so.
So did you sympathize with Joey because
he
lived in the house with parents like that?
No, because to tell you the truth, we'd probably get the same treatment from our parents if we went around the block and weren't told where we were supposed to go.
So it's just kind of kids against the adults.
Of course.
Kind of
that's what it was like. They're taking care of him, just like we weren't allowed to go out after a certain time. He wasn't allowed out. It was all very natural, normal.
Any idea, Karen, why he went to the church?
You know, I don't know. I would think that he went to church to pray for all the bad things he heard on television. Because he had such a soft spot inside him that was so sensitive. And so I think, you know, we were raised Italian Catholic, you know, so I think it's that whole, you know, so anytime you can get on your knees.
A lot of respect for
the church
in the family.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, okay.
And just, I think so. I think maybe that's what he was praying for. I don't think he was praying to be let out. I don't think that was in his mind. Maybe it was. Just thought of that, didn't I? I'm not
so,
sure.
So how did it play out? When's the last time you saw Joey?
30.
30 years.
Yeah. It's been about 30.
So he moved out of the neighborhood or you did?
No, I did. I left as soon as I could. So, yeah, I got out of there and then...
And did he stay?
Oh, yeah. His parents both stayed. And what happened was that years later, I think Joey was probably in his late 40s, early 50s, and his parents passed away. And Joey's brother took him in and his wife. And they kept Joey.
So at that point, he'd left the neighborhood.
He left the neighborhood and didn't move far, like 5 blocks away.
Right.
And I'd hear through my mom, who's still his aunts were her girlfriends. So she would always let me. I'd always ask how he's doing. And they'd say, fine. But, you know, Joey, you didn't visit Joey. I'd never been in Joey's house. In his room upstairs on the second floor in his apartment. Downstairs, aunts and uncles all lived down there. And we could go in there, but...
And even as an adult, even in his 40s and 50s, do you know if he ever outgrew this passion for escaping? I mean, was he still kind of like a prisoner in the house?
You know, I don't know, because I wonder if maybe he made new friends outside the house.
Right.
Maybe he was in another window with other kids.
Well, maybe he worked. Maybe he found kind of workshop job that he could do.
Yep, I hope so.
I'm talking with Karen Dalton about her childhood friend, Joey. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Karen told me that Joey's on her mind these days because very recently she got some sad news.
Well, he passed away. My mother called me in the afternoon and said that Joey passed away in the hospital. And he was 61, which was a long time to live. So I felt really sad for him. And it really made me remember him again. I hadn't for years. And, so for the next 2 or 3 days, you know, I kept going to my studio and I would do a little work and just think of all these things and about Joey. So I decided to go in and write about him. Just write down little things and about his life. Just to get it, I felt like I needed to connect with him somehow.
What was it that came back to you?
Oh, first it was his face in that window with that T-shirt on all the time. And brought me back to my neighborhood and my old friends and how he was part of all my old friends there.
One of the little vignettes you wrote about was a snowman. What's that story?
Yeah, well, we used to, you know, in the winter we didn't play outside very much because it was really cold. So when we did get out after school or on a weekend, if it snowed, we'd make a snowman. And in front of Annette's house is where Joey could look down from the side of the window, the corner window, past the roof line to the big tree where we'd play hide and seek. And we'd make a snowman there because we had a tree in front of our houses and a little bit of dirt. So we'd always make a snowman with him, you know. And that's just what we did. We'd make some igloos.
You'd make it somewhere where Joey could see the snowman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'd make
him
down the block.
You could have made it anywhere, but why not make it somewhere where he could see it, right?
Yeah, we'd make one for him. Yeah, we'd make one right there. And then we'd make one in front of our house and... You know, we'd go around making them anywhere. But we always made one for him, you know, when we remembered and when a few of us kids were together. You know, a lot of times, you know, we'd get let out at different times or who couldn't go out. And, you know, we'd just go and call up at the window, you know, and he was behind a storm window in the winter.
But he'd wave.
Oh, yeah. Or he'd open it up a little bit and talk, you know, crack it open a little tiny bit and talk through that. And then you knew his mom said, close the window, because he turned his head and was like, zip. Down.
Do you think that you learned anything from Joey or for having been a kid with Joey in a neighboring house?
Well, people who have any sort of handicap, I feel very special about. And I was thinking about it the past few days that every Friday the nuns used to pick us up at school. because we had to go to catechism. So we'd have to walk past our house on a Friday, past the house, past Joey's house, down to the church to have catechism. So we would all look up, and he'd be waiting for us. And there'd be about 15 kids, and a lot of them weren't in our neighborhood. They were kids from all over. And they all knew him, too. So they'd wave, and their arms would just go up. So that was pretty neat.
Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Karen Dalton. She's a stained glass artist who lives near Bynum, North Carolina. Now, tell me that Karen's story didn't get you thinking about a story or a person like that that you know, that you remember. So do me a favor, jot down a few lines, just a few lines at our website. We'll get in touch with you and take care of all the hard work. You can find us at thestory.org. And while you're there at our website, you can, in fact, read those notes, that essay that Karen mentioned. She wrote about her memories of Joey. You can also leave me a message at our toll-free line. The number is 1-888-966-9862. 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.